The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily radio show. Last week, Iraqi forces launched an offensive to retake Fallujah from the Islamic State, one of the first Iraqi cities to be captured by ISIS. That happened back in January of 2014. And, the offensive was launched, I believe, last Friday or Saturday, and then yesterday, as reported by a number of news outlets, Iraqi forces, even though they have Fallujah surrounded, they suspended their attack because they're worried about what might happen to 50,000 civilians, including as many as 20,000 children who are trapped inside of the city. Many of these civilians, the London Times reports, have already endured 2 years of near starvation, and then, of course, living under ISIS, terrorized by ISIS. The Times says that some of these civilians are even opting for suicide. They're opting for suicide over the prospect of starving to death or being used as human shields against the Iraqi offensive. Think about those options. Trapped as a civilian inside Fallujah and wondering if you should commit suicide or starve to death or end up being used as a human shield. Now, at the same time, many of the civilians in Fallujah, it's a Sunni stronghold, so many of them don't trust the Iranian-backed government in Baghdad, or the Iranian-backed Shiite militias who are supposedly coming to liberate Fallujah. You talk about being caught between a rock and a hard place. The Baltimore Sun wrote yesterday, it said, one reason many Fallujah residents were receptive to ISIS's takeover 2 years ago is that they had become deeply disillusioned by former Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki's policies, which marginalized their interests in the central government. So they were disillusioned. They didn't put much resistance up to ISIS coming in there. And from some of the reports I've read, there's only about 400 or 500 ISIS terrorists in the city, which in itself would suggest that maybe a lot of the Sunnis in that city don't mind it. In any event, some of the other reports, as I just noted, are pointing out the dire conditions for so many of the civilians that are living there. Now, of course, the main reason there's so much bloodshed, there's so much chaos in Fallujah, in Iraq, in Syria, is because of America's withdrawal from the region.
Compared to when I came into office, when we had nearly 180,000 American troops in Afghanistan and Iraq, today that number is less than 15,000. Most of our troops have come home. Our local partners on the ground are in the lead.
That's from President Obama's commencement yesterday at the Air Force Academy in Colorado Springs. He's bragging about going from 180,000 troops down to 15,000. And he says there, if you see, you heard at the end, our local partners on the ground are in the lead. We'll expand on that more as we proceed. But you know some of the recent history. America paid a heavy price to overtake Fallujah back in 2004. And then we handed Fallujah over and the rest of Iraq to our partners on the ground, namely Iran. Mohammed Bazzi, I believe is how you say his name, he wrote a commentary yesterday for Reuters. And the title is, "With Washington Looking the Other Way, Iran Fills a Void in Iraq." Now, where have you heard this before? Who was talking about this? Even as U.S. troops were entering into Iraq in 2003, "With Washington Looking the Other Way, Iran Fills a Void in Iraq." He said, this commentator, he said that the fight for Fallujah highlights Iran's growing power over the region. That's what all of this highlights. He wrote, if there's one regional player that gained the most from America's gamble in Iraq, it is Iran. With its invasion in 2003, the United States ousted Tehran's sworn enemy, Saddam Hussein, from power. And Bazzi goes on to talk about how Iran has really excelled at the long game. I mean, 2003, the U.S. troops coming in there, toppling Saddam. And then there's the surge in 2007. But you think about just how that helped Iran, removing the one obstacle, the biggest obstacle, certainly, standing in the way of Iran becoming the regional hegemon. Saddam Hussein and his regime. And then all during the U.S. occupation, as you know, Iran funded and supported the Iraqi insurgency against U.S. forces. They were actively working against American forces, fighting, killing American soldiers. And then finally in 2011, U.S. troops left Iraq and Iran rushed to fill the vacuum, along with Sunni militants like the Islamic State. Bazzi writes this, "After Islamic State militants swept through northern Iraq in June 2014, Tehran once again mobilized to protect the Shiite-led government from the Sunni militant threat. Soleimani, that's the Iranian general, Soleimani traveled to Baghdad at the start of the crisis to coordinate the defense of the capital with Iraqi military officials." You remember, Iraq wasn't disappointed at all at our departure. Pretty much said, okay, see you later. We'll look to Iran. It says here, "Soleimani also directed Iranian-trained Shiite militias, including the Badr Brigade and the League of the Righteous, two notorious militias responsible for widespread atrocities against Sunnis." You can see why the Sunnis are looking in both directions, those in Fallujah, and saying, well, these are both bad choices. You have these ISIS terrorists that have basically cut off the city from the rest of the world. People nearly starving to death. And then these notorious militias barreling down on Fallujah. Militias that are responsible for widespread atrocities against Sunnis. Bazzi says here, "With a weakened and corrupt Iraqi military, the militias proved crucial in stopping the jihadists' advance." Iran, in other words, proved crucial in stopping the advance of ISIS. Now, the best part of this is, from Iran's perspective, is that it can rush to fill the power void in Iraq and do it with America's blessing. That's what it's now doing with this offensive against Fallujah. It's doing it with the full support and help and assistance from the United States. Both nations, and this is hard to believe knowing the most recent history, but both nations, America and Iran, share a common interest in defeating what the West now sees as the greatest threat to global stability, or certainly one of the greatest, and that's the Islamic State. And so here is America fighting alongside the Iranians, or to be more precise, they're providing air cover But it's the, as we've noted before on this program, it's the Iranians who have the boots on the ground. It's the Iranian, the general, that's giving the orders. Bazzi says, without committing far more U.S. troops and resources, there's little that Washington can do to counter Iranian power in Iraq. There's just very little that it can do. It says, and Tehran will not hesitate to use its many levers of influence over Saddam Hussein's former dominion. Now, like I said, who was there telling you where this was leading? We'll get more into this in the second segment. I don't want to get ahead of myself. But if you've been a reader of The Trumpet, if you've been following thetrumpet.com, if you're a regular viewer of the Key of David program, then you know this is all playing out. Even if we didn't know all of the specific details, but in stepping back and looking at the big picture, it's all playing out just as the Bible prophesied. Carolyn Glick points out in her latest column, it was posted yesterday, she says that Iran will take full advantage of all of this chaos in order to advance its regional ambitions. It wants to be the regional power. It wants to dominate the region of the Middle East. That's what's going on here. And Glick, I mean, in her column, she addresses her fellow Israelis and essentially says, look, we're well aware of the dangerous threats right around our borders. Lebanon, Gaza, and so on. We're well aware of the dangerous threats within our borders, in the West Bank, in East Jerusalem. But do we see what's happening beyond our borders? In Syria, in Iraq, in Iran. She says strategic thinking has always been Israel's Achilles heel. Strategic thinking. It's always been Israel's Achilles heel. And of course, you could say that America has had the same weakness.
If Iran and Russia want to spill their blood and treasure trying to prop up their Syrian client and get sucked into a quagmire, that is their choice. As President of the United States, I've made a different choice. And the only real solution to the Syrian conflict is a political solution, including a transition away from Assad. And that takes diplomacy. Not American soldiers being dragged into the middle of another civil war in the Middle East.
That's what President Obama told the Air Force cadets yesterday in Colorado Springs. Look, we've got to embrace diplomacy or other non-lethal means to solve the problems of this world. There's got to be a political solution. We just can't send in troops and expect to solve anything. In fact, this is a point in our favor. We used to have 180,000 troops over there. Now it's 15,000. Yes, and Iran is running roughshod over the region. Notice how President Obama defended his non-enforcement of the red line on Assad's use of chemical weapons in Syria.
I know, for example, that my decision not to conduct strikes against Syria after it used chemical weapons was controversial among some in Washington. But because we seized a diplomatic option backed by our threat of force, nations came together and we accomplished far more than military strikes ever could have. All of Syria's declared chemical weapons were successfully removed.
He sees what's happened in Syria as a victory. We've accomplished far more than military strikes ever could have. A 500,000 people have been slaughtered in the Syrian civil war. And whether they're shot by bullets individually or by missiles or bombed with chemical weapons, however they die, we are talking about a massacre on a grand scale. 500,000 people. But now, even with that, what's happening there, what's happening in Iraq, as Glick brings out in her column, We've got to look even beyond the human tragedy and devastation that we can see right in front of us and step back and look at the big picture. It's astounding what's happened in just the last few years. These last few years since the so-called Arab Spring. Carolyn Glick says Syria, Iraq, Lebanon, Yemen, these states no longer exist. They no longer exist. And at the same time, what else do we see? We see Iran on the march. We see Iran on the march in each of these territories. Glick says, today ISIS is the only thing checking Iran's westward advance. Ironically, the monstrous group also facilitates it. How about that? And here again, where have you read this before? Where have you heard about this? ISIS is there in some ways checking the westward advance of Iran and at the same time facilitating it. Glick says ISIS is so demonic that for Americans and other Westerners, empowering Iranian-controlled forces that fight ISIS seem a small price to pay to rid the world of a fanatical scourge. And so, okay, it has the support of the West. It has the support of the United States. Iran does. And meanwhile, ISIS serves as an advance guard for Iran. It suits their interests to have this so-called enemy. Glick says the battle for Fallujah is a clear indication that Iran, rather than the U.S., is calling the shots in Iraq. According to media reports, the Pentagon wanted and expected for the forces to be concentrated in Mosul, but at the last minute, due to Soleimani's intervention, the Iraqi government decided to make Fallujah the offensive's center of gravity. The Americans had no choice but to go along with the Iranian plan because, well, Iran is outflanking the U.S. in Iraq. Iran's calling the shots. Soleimani's running the show. And he's being given cover by the United States in more ways than one. In this column, and if you can get to it, Carolyn Glick's piece, you should read it, because she offers a fascinating analysis on President Obama's strategy in Iraq and in the Middle East, and the influence of Ben Rhodes. He's the president's foreign policy guru. We've talked about this. You remember the story from May 5th, the New York Times Magazine, by Samuels, I forget his first name, David Samuels maybe. But we learned last month from that feature in the New York Times, we learned about Rhodes' Middle East strategy. He's the foreign policy guru. And as that New York Times Magazine brings out, Carolyn Glick draws attention to this, Rhodes' Middle East strategy was formed before he took up the position in President Obama's administration. Well, he actually joined Obama in 2007 when he was a senator preparing for his campaign run for president. But before that, he was working with the Iraq Study Group, this group that released a report in 2006, which, according to the New York Times Magazine, and it had been a while since I had read bits and pieces about this report, but the New York Times reminds us that it excoriated George Bush's war in Iraq. And then it brings out, this again is noted in the New York Times Magazine, that Ben Rhodes wrote most of it. He wrote most of this 2006 report that was submitted to President Bush. And Carolyn Glick says these are some of the report's recommendations Firstly, that American forces should be withdrawn from Iraq as soon as possible. As soon as possible. And of course, if you know anything about the way President Obama or Senator Obama campaigned, he was on the campaign trail calling for this. Over and again, we need to get our troops out of there as soon as possible. Another recommendation from the report in 2006, that Iran and Syria should be encouraged to fight against the remaining remnants of Al-Qaeda. Those remnants that later developed into ISIS, as we now know. And then also from that 2006 report, Ben Rhodes and the others on that committee suggested that we give Iran incentive to help us to fight against Al-Qaeda, to cooperate with America by ending America's attempt to curb Iran's nuclear ambitions. Now, that's what Ben Rhodes and the Iraq Study Group recommended to George Bush in 2006. Of course, President Bush at that time, he rejected these recommendations. And then, of course, in 2007, he unleashed the surge. More U.S. forces in Iraq. And this was a successful strategy, at least for a time. The surge in 2007. And then, of course, that very year, Ben Rhodes joined Senator Obama's campaign for becoming the next U.S. president. But this is the analysis that Carolyn Glick makes in just looking back at some of this history and of course, following what Samuels brought out in that New York Times Magazine feature about Ben Rhodes, the aspiring novelist who became President Obama's foreign policy guru. Now we see, as Carolyn Glick brings out, that through Rhodes, the Iraq Study Group's recommendations became the blueprint for a new U.S. strategy of retreat and Iranian ascendance in Iraq and throughout the Middle East. This has been the policy from the beginning, as we've covered on this program. She says the chief components of that strategy have already been implemented. The U.S. withdrawal from Iraq in 2011 left Iran as the new power broker in the country. The nuclear pact with Iran facilitated Iran's transformation into the regional hegemon. Against this strategic shift, the U.S.'s minimalist campaigns in Iraq and Syria against ISIS make sense. She says the U.S. forces aren't there to defeat ISIS, but to conceal Iran's rise. That's what our minimalist campaign in Iraq is doing. No boots on the ground, just a bit of air cover. And what is it accomplishing? Ultimately, it's concealing the rise of the King of the South. You Google it today, get an update on Fallujah and what's happening there. You'll still find articles that talk about the U.S. campaign to retake Fallujah from ISIS. And you'll probably find a good many that don't even mention Iran. Maybe they'll say something like the Iranian-backed Shiite militias. But it's Iran. And here we are providing perfect cover for them. Not only air cover on the battlefield, but perfectly covering or concealing their rise as the regional king. And she urges her readers that we need to understand the implications of this working alliance that President Obama has built with Iran. You put all of the pieces together, you connect all of the dots, the nuclear program, the way they went about getting this to go through by lying after well, all through the process. Withdrawal of our troops. Handing it over to Iran. Glick says in this new strategic environment, Israel must stop viewing Gaza, Judea and Samaria, the Golan Heights, and Lebanon as standalone battlefields. We must not be taken in by the regional peace plans that would curtail our maneuver room. And we must bear in mind these new conditions as we negotiate a new U.S. military assistance package. The name of the game, here's how she concludes it, the name of the game today is chess. The entire Middle East is one great board. When a pawn moves in Gaza, it affects the queen in Tehran. And when a knight moves in Fallujah, it threatens the queen in Jerusalem. There's a bigger picture here to focus in on. She sees the real threat. It's not Hamas. It's not Hezbollah. It's Iran. It's the king of the south. It's the head of the snake. And when the knight moves on Fallujah, well, Jerusalem is in danger. Now you consider what the Bible has to say about this coming clash between the king of the south and the king of the north, the European beast power. Daniel 11:40 says, "And at the time of the end shall the king of the south push at him, and the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind, with chariots and with horsemen and with many ships. And he shall enter into the countries and shall overflow and pass over." You can read this key prophecy, not just verse 40, but all the way through verse 43, and you really get a good idea of who's in the mix here. But it says there in verse 40 that this is to happen at the time of the end. Isn't it now obvious who the king of the south is? Just in case you doubted back when we were talking about it in 1994, 22 years ago. My father wrote about it in the King of the South booklet. He said, Iran will undoubtedly lead the King of the South. The power will be comprised of the radical Islamic movement. Iran is working fiercely to lead this radically militant religion. This King of the South is undoubtedly the Iran-led radical Muslims. They're strong and they're pushing. They're pushing others around in the Middle East. That's from over 20 years ago. 20 years ago. You know, this past week I saw some stories on Bernard Lewis, the Middle Eastern scholar, who back in 1976 was warning about the rise of radical Islam. And all of these glowing reports, and they should praise him, because he was saying things in the 1970s and 80s that no other geopolitical commentator was saying. And others have gotten credit, like Samuel Huntington, about the clash of civilizations, which is really something that Bernard Lewis saw years before Huntington did. In any event, there's all this worthy praise for someone who saw the emergence of radical Islam and a future clash of civilizations. And here he is today. He's 100 years old. He's still alive and kicking. He's not writing and speaking like before, but his legacy is there in all of his writings. And it's the same with God's work. Now, we might not win the praise of commentators, of geopolitical analysts, of historians, but the track record, nevertheless, is all there. You can go back on our website and see it. I mean, we quote it and we re-quote it often. God's given us these insights, even more details and more specifics than what Bernard Lewis or any other human being has come up with. because God was talking about it in the book of Daniel. This goes back thousands of years. Thousands of years. So based on this prophecy, we spoke about first in 92, then more directly in 1994, and then you can see why. It influenced everything that we've said from that point forward. U.S. forces head into Iraq in 2003. A big show of force. I mean, who can ever forget the image of Saddam Hussein, that great statue, just tumbling over? And then Saddam himself hunted down. What a show of force by the United States of America. And in that same year, my father wrote, 2003, June 2003, it may seem shocking given the U.S. presence in the region right now, but prophecy indicates that in pursuit of its goal, Iran will probably take over Iraq. At least it will have a heavy influence over the Iraqi people. So that's what we said 13 years ago this month. And today, well, you see Iran in Iraq, exerting heavy influence over the Iraqi people, giving the orders on the ground. Well, let's go into Mosul first, says the State Department. No, we're going to Fallujah, says Soleimani. We are headed to Fallujah. You see who the king of the South is. And as Glick brings out in her column today, well, the United States isn't there to conquer ISIS. It's there to conceal the rise of Iran. And as we'll see here in the next segment, Iran's not even there to obliterate ISIS. There are clashes with ISIS for sure, like in Fallujah and elsewhere. But it suits Iran's global ambitions to have ISIS in the neighborhood, because that too helps to conceal the rise of the king of the South. You're listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show on KPCG 101.3 on the FM dial in Edmond, Oklahoma. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
The prophet Daniel wrote about a future confrontation between a power in the north and the king of the south. We are now in the time when these two major powers are quickly rising. The King of the South is stirring up trouble even today. It is critical that you know the identity of this prophesied power. For more, request our booklet, King of the South. Visit thetrumpet.com and click the Literature tab to select your free booklet.
From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England. This is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Flurry.
Iran, the number one state sponsor of terrorism by far, has bludgeoned its way into controlling Lebanon and Gaza and has become the backbone of Syrian terrorism. Iran also has bombed and butchered its way into the dominant role in Iraq and Afghanistan and is empowering the Muslim Brotherhood terrorism to get control of Egypt. Now, America and the West have paved the way for another Iranian victory in Libya.
Paved the way, America did, for another victory in Libya. That's from my father's Key of David program in 2011, September of 2011, when the U.S. went in there just like it did with Iraq in 2003. Took out Gaddafi, and pave the way for more chaos, more turmoil. Brad McDonald had an article, well, it's already in the most recent Trumpet magazine, July 2016. It was posted last week, a week ago, on our website. You know, I read Carolyn Glick's piece this morning, and, you know, you read just an awesome column like that and get real excited about, wow, that's an insightful piece. She's pretty sharp. But then I think about, I mean, after I got excited, I think, but look at what we have posted on the Trumpet every other day. And in that article that went up last week, Brad McDonald's article, the title, The Islamic State and Iran on the Same Team. And he brings out some of the very same points, just in a little bit of a different way, that Glick did today. And here's an article that was done weeks ago. He sets up his article by saying the West is looking at the Islamic State and it sees ISIS as the number one global terrorist threat. And so this is the main objective. And of course, it's kind of a half-hearted minimalist effort to defeat ISIS, like Glick brings out. But nevertheless, that's the main enemy. It's certainly not Iran. We're working with Iran. We have a partnership with Iran on this. We need Iran's help. We share a common interest. Well, we think it is. We want to see ISIS destroyed. Does Iran want to see ISIS destroyed? Brad McDonald's article is titled The Islamic State and Iran on the Same Team. What are their goals? What are their ambitions, ultimately? You want to talk about common interests? Brad McDonald says it's dangerous to assume that Iran thinks the same way about the Islamic State as the West does. The truth is, the Islamic State's rise has proven enormously beneficial to Iran, the world's top state sponsor of terrorism. Iran's the world's top state sponsor. And having ISIS in the neighborhood has proven to be enormously beneficial to Iran's ambitions. He says, first, the Islamic State has distracted America and the West from Iran's terrorist activities. Thanks to ISIS, Iran's no longer on the West radar as a terrorist threat. What a development this is for Iran. It's like a gift. It's been wrapped for them ahead of time and just handed to them on the doorstep. Brad McDonald says, second, the presence of the Islamic State gives Iran an opportunity to refashion its reputation in the region and globally. Iran's leaders regularly deliver statements promising to defend the persecuted from the Islamic State and to bring stability to Iraq and the broader region. Well, look at what they're doing now. They had the offensive off and running. They had Fallujah encircled, but now they're holding back. Because, you see, they're concerned about the civilians. They're concerned about these Sunni civilians. They have refashioned their image, at least with respect to the West. Saudi Arabia is not blind to what's happening. Many of the other Sunni states in the region, they see what's happening. Brad McDonald says, Tehran is exploiting the violence and instability created by ISIS to cast itself as the region's savior. What a transformation. Now it's not the world's number one terrorist sponsoring nation. It's the regional savior. Third, Brad McDonald says, the rise of the Islamic State has provided Iran with the opportunity to bolster its military presence in Iraq and Syria. It's no longer providing arms or encouragement to those militias. In many cases, they are Iranian soldiers. Look at all of the facts. It's obvious. It's obvious that the rise of the Islamic State has strengthened Iran's position in the region. It's boosted Iran's reputation, like Mr. McDonald brings out, in the international community. And it's enabled Iran also to extract all kinds of concessions from the United States. Look at the nuclear deal. Or look at any of the other areas in the region where Iran is antagonizing and stirring up conflict and strife. You think if America applies a little bit of pressure, they're going to pull back? Or are they going to respond by saying, hey, you leave us alone. You need us to keep ISIS in check. You are pleading with us to make this nuclear deal. It's amazing all that's happened. Mr. McDonald brings out that with respect to ISIS, Iran's goal there is to just manage ISIS's activities, not to eliminate its presence. Okay, so Fallujah is pushing up a little bit too close to home, a little bit too close to the Iranian border. So they'll take care of Fallujah, they'll take care of Mosul. If they wanted to eliminate ISIS's presence, they could have done that by now. They don't want to do that. Because leaving ISIS in the neighborhood helps to conceal the rise of the King of the South. Carolyn Glick said it right. ISIS is the only thing checking Iran's westward advance. Ironically, the monstrous group also facilitates it. She said later in her piece that where ISIS leads, Iran will follow. Iran is right there. Look at a map. Fallujah, Mosul, they're close to Iran. They're also close to Jordan. It's also pushing up closer to Israel. And this is what Carolyn Glick is saying. Look, we've got to examine our strategic thinking because this has been an Achilles heel for Israel. We can't just look at what's right in front of us in Gaza, in the West Bank, in Lebanon. Look at what the king is doing. Look at what the number one state sponsor of terror is doing. And so ISIS is providing cover. And as it happens, what an incredibly strange twist in these developments from the past 13, 14 years that U.S. forces are there now, not to defeat ISIS, but to really conceal Iran's rise. You go back to what Ben Rhodes was recommending in 2006 with that Iraq Survey Group report. The number one foreign policy guru for President Obama, and it's all playing out according to his playbook. Now, look at what Brad McDonald says. This is at thetrumpet.com. Last week, Iran has no interest in eliminating the Islamic State from the Middle East, and certainly not from Europe or the West. Iran has two basic ambitions. First, it wants to be the dominant power in the Middle East. Second, it wants to undermine and destroy Israel, America, and the West. And right now, the presence of the Islamic State is helping Iran achieve these ambitions. And you could add to that the presence of the United States in the region, the minimalist campaign by the United States, it's also helping Iran to achieve those ambitions. Notice further what my father had to say in that 2011 Key of David program, clip 5.
Now that's a deadly change that is taking place in the Middle East. And what most people still do not understand is that Iran rules the Middle East. And they are going to drag nations into war. I mean, look at where they're going and how they're pushing, as Daniel says, over and over and over, and it could bring the whole world into a World War III because they're about to get nuclear bombs.
Now, you're just simply not getting that message anywhere else. Occasionally, you get a real whopper of a column like Carolyn Glick's today. But as far as the consistent, hard-hitting message based squarely on Bible prophecy, you're only going to get that from God's work. You're listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show on KPCG 101.3 on the FM dial in Edmond, Oklahoma. Hey, we're coming up on the weekend. Why don't you email the program at td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
But we don't realize, and this world doesn't realize, how much Iran is ruling the Middle East and taking it over and giving it over to the most vile kind of terrorism and war.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Are we living in the last days? Some dismiss the notion as fanatical, but world leaders and news analysts are issuing warnings that are becoming more and more dire. Could Bible prophecies about the last days actually be accurate? Our brochure can help guide you through the relevant news and history and help you compare these events to what the Bible says. Are we living in the last days? This brochure is available for free right now at thetrumpet.com. This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
We are blessed to be living in the most peaceful, most prosperous era in human history.
That's one of President Obama's favorite lines, judging by his recent speeches. That was, again, him from his commencement yesterday at the Air Force Academy in Colorado Springs. And it made me think again of this this quote we used earlier this week and last week on a video that we put together for TV here in the UK. It's from Lesson 2 of the Armstrong College Bible Correspondence course, where it says, "The world does not have long to wait before astounding earth-shaking events will begin to jolt people out of complacency. It won't be long before the hard shells of skepticism are smashed and shattered. It's not going to be much longer before people see that something is terribly wrong." 1 Thessalonians 5, I'll just conclude today's show by going through a few verses here. And here again with a couple of these verses, we've used them a few times here of late. But we're certainly not living in the times of prosperity and peace. Try telling that to the 50,000 civilians in Fallujah, or the 500,000 victims in Syria, or the millions of refugees running for their lives. Okay, so the nuclear bombs haven't exploded again. It hasn't happened yet. It hasn't happened since 1945. But there's plenty of them around the world sitting there just waiting for the trigger. 1 Thessalonians 5 and verse 1, Paul says, "But of the times and seasons, brethren, you have no need that I write unto you." You in the church, true Christians, I mean, you should know about this message. What season we're in. It says in verse 2, "For yourselves know perfectly that the day of the Lord so comes as a thief in the night." That's when Jesus Christ is going to return to this earth, as bad as it's getting. Still, man won't expect it. Man doesn't want it. We'll go right on saying, oh, we're just so blessed to be living in this peaceful, prosperous time. The most peaceful, most prosperous era in human history. How about that for a statement? Jesus Christ is going to return to this earth at an unexpected hour. Now, this verse doesn't mean he's coming secretly, as some believe. It just means that mankind won't expect it. They won't be looking for it. But they should be looking for it. If they just look into the Bible and become aware of the times and the seasons and be made aware of the prophecies of God. Verse 3, for when they shall say peace and safety, then sudden destruction comes upon them as travail upon a woman with child, and they shall not escape. It's going to spring on us just like a trap. Phillips' translation says, catastrophe will sweep down upon them as suddenly and inescapably as birth pangs to a pregnant woman. All this happens when? Well, at a time when they're out there, the world leaders, the diplomats, the high-ranking officials, the presidents and prime ministers, when they're out there saying peace and safety, blessings and prosperity. Verse 4 says, but you, brethren, this is 1 Thessalonians 5 and verse 4, but you, brethren, are not in darkness, that day should overtake you as a thief. I mean, you know the truth. You're not in darkness. You're not blind to what's happening. You know what's coming. Verse 5, you are children of light and the children of the day. We are not of the night nor of darkness. We're not going around in darkness. Our minds have been opened to the truth. Children of the light, Jesus Christ came into this world as a light to the world. But it says in John 3 that men love darkness. They love to go to sleep. They love to tune out. They love to turn a blind eye to Fallujah, to sub-Saharan Africa, to the murders in Chicago, to the refugees leaving Syria, leaving Libya, to the chaos and the division and the bloodshed all across North Africa, throughout the Middle East. Verse 6 says, therefore, let us not sleep as do others, but let us watch and be sober. Don't go to sleep like so many others. Wake up and watch. Be sober. Watch unto prayer, the Apostle Peter said. We have to stay awake spiritually. We have to stay on guard duty, so to speak. We can't be spiritually drunk on the wrong teachings or on the cares of this world. We have to be sober, sober-minded in all of our thoughts. Verse 7 says, for they that sleep, sleep in the night, and they that be drunken are drunken in the night. But let us, Paul says, who are of the day, be sober, putting on the breastplate of faith and love, and for a helmet, the hope of salvation. A nice little synopsis there of the spiritual armor chapter over in Ephesians 6. Verse 9 says, for God has not appointed us to wrath, but to obtain salvation by our Lord Jesus Christ, who died for us, that whether we wake or sleep, we should live together with him. Wherefore, verse 11 says, comfort yourselves together and edify one another, even as also you do. Comfort each other with these precious words. Comfort one another with these hope-filled words. Comfort one another with this message from God. Well, in the minute or two that I have left, I'll see if I can get through one or two emails. We've had some nice emails come in this week. This first one here, coming from Austin, Texas. He writes, I awake early each morning, begin the spiritual battle before my feet hit the floor, meditate and pray, get the coffee on its way, and sit down in my office to log on and to be ready to join you live each weekday morning to hear the news, understand who did what to whom, and to be given the daily bread of insight into God's beautiful unfolding truth, mercy, and true love for all of mankind. Today, he's commenting on yesterday's program, today as not a few times before in your 246 broadcasts to date. Today was particularly moving because of the spiritually masterful way you orchestrate a moving myriad of events, trends, and prophecies into a clear and focused expression of the truly wonderful gospel of the soon coming kingdom of God. This small but stupendous worldwide broadcast is a foretaste of great things to come. One other one here, quickly. It says, your message on the proverb for doubters was so powerful, it was one of the strongest messages I've heard on TD recently. He says, and with the old radio clips of Mr. Armstrong's voice crying out, just made me so thankful for the fact that your father picked up the mantle of Elijah, and the same message continues to be delivered today. Thank you for all of your support. Well, thank you, all of you listeners, for your support for KPCG and the trumpet and my father and the Key of David. It's a wonderful blessing and privilege to be involved in supporting God's end of the end time work. You're listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show on KPCG 101.3 on the FM dial in Edmond, Oklahoma. We're coming to the end of another week of broadcasting. We thank you for joining us today and all through this past week, and we'll look forward to seeing you again on Monday.